With new legal risks and regulatory challenges constantly arising, how can we stay current and be best prepared? Join me, your host, Ronald J. Coleman of Georgetown Law for Compliance and Legal Risk, a podcast brought to you by Georgetown Law and EY. In each episode, I interview thought leaders in areas relating to legal risk and regulatory compliance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Compliance and Legal Risk. I'm your host, Ronald J. Coleman, but I informally go by RJ. Today's episode is on e-discovery, the challenges of social media and other ephemeral data types. And I'm very lucky to be joined today by two very distinguished guests, Jennifer Joyce and Judge John M. Facciola. So to kick things off, I figured I would ask our speakers to tell us a little bit more about themselves, what they do, and how they got there. Judge Facciola, do you want to start?
Yes, I'm a washed-up magistrate judge. I served as a United States magistrate judge in the District of Columbia for 17 glorious years. I've been involved with information technology for a long time, including those 17 years. And I've written many opinions upon it and participated in a couple of books about it as well.
And you teach for us as well.
Yes, I teach at some school in Washington, D.C. I teach at Georgetown Law, where I teach evidence, contracts, constitutional law, and a special course called Information Technology and Modern Litigation, which I guess is a pretty good summary of my interests.
Well, we're happy to have you. Jennifer?
Thanks, RJ. Jennifer Joyce. I am a senior manager with Ernst & Young. I focus primarily on information governance and e-discovery, and I have been in this field for about 15 years. And so I'm really happy to be here today and have frequently come across ephemeral data and social media through the course of my career. So I'm excited to explore this with you all today.
Great. So before we get into the main part of the discussion, I thought it would be helpful for us and for our listeners just to define some of the terms that we're going to be discussing. So when we say e-discovery, what do we mean by that?
Well, up until a relatively recent amendment, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure did not even define a document to include ESI. So that's how far behind the legal system was behind the world. When we talk about ESI, we mean data generated or created by the use of a computer. It becomes of legal significance because it is now expressly made discoverable by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
And is most discovery at this stage e-discovery?
It's hard to imagine any other kind of discovery. I understand that any given year, 98% of all the communications on the face of the earth are digital. As a result, nearly all of the information involved in the criminals in the justice system is in electronic format. I don't know of much other kind of discovery, at least in terms of a production by a party. Obviously, we still have depositions and things like that, but it's really taken over, particularly in the business cases where it's about the only discovery there is.
And Jennifer, we're going to be discussing ephemeral data types, and I was hoping maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what's meant by ephemeral data and maybe some of the more important forms of ephemeral data.
Yeah, I think ephemeral data is one of those terms that, depending on who you talk to, you might get a different response. I also think that ephemeral data has really evolved over the past few years. So if you think about ephemeral data in more of a traditional sense, you might think about system processes that generate temp files. Necessarily, these don't always have user-generated content or provide much value in a day-to-day business context. But then I think as we saw the emergence of communication and collaboration systems, as well as social media and social media networks, the definition has really evolved to describe data that more or less lives for a snapshot or a short period of time, is generally dynamic in nature. And the concept of ephemerality itself may vary by the types of platforms that are used to generate this concept. So I think that this is something that we will continue to see evolve as technology and these data sources keep on trend with our working from home, remote environments, as well as navigate, I think, some of the privacy legislations that's coming our way globally and within the U.S. But generally speaking, I think that ephemeral data is really that data that exists for a short period of time, and it's not intended to live forever.
So as we go through our discussion, I think if there's different distinctions that would be relevant to our listeners, for instance, if the answer to a question might be different depending on the type of ephemeral data that we're discussing, I think it would be helpful for our listeners if you could point that out.
Absolutely.
So now let's move on to the platforms and duties. So to start things off, do lawyers have a duty to investigate social media and ephemeral data?
It would depend in what context it arises. In a litigation context, obviously no one is obliged to keep anything as a general rule. Supreme Court made that clear in Arthur Anderson. But once litigation has occurred or is reasonably anticipated, there is the trigger of an obligation to not dispose of information that may be relevant. Corporations and others respond to that by imposing what is called a litigation hold. It is usually written directions given to all of the people in that association or corporation as to what they have to keep and guidance as to how to maintain it until it can be collected. So in that sense, once that event occurs, no matter how the data is described, ephemeral or otherwise, if it bears on this lawsuit and is, in the judgment of a lawyer, relevant, then somebody's going to have to figure out how to preserve it. The problem here is if it is not designed to be captured, how will a lawyer fulfill that responsibility? My own view would be that if the lawyer finds that the time has come for the litigation hold to be set on this corporation's data, then the lawyer may have a possible obligation to find out where in the organization is there ephemeral data and what is its significance for this lawsuit. So in that sense, the lawyer does that have that obligation, but only when it is triggered by an obligation to keep stuff by a litigation hold. Maybe a statutory duty. For example, the EEOC has a regulation about what you have to keep, taxing authorities and so forth. That's another aspect for it. But in litigation, we are looking for that moment where there's an anticipation of litigation or litigation has commenced. That is the source of the obligation the lawyer has.
So you have a litigation hold. There's anticipation of litigation. You find out that you're supposed to check and collect from various data sources, including ephemeral data. What platforms should folks be looking at when they're in that situation? In other words, where should you be looking for ephemeral data?
Yeah, so I think there's two aspects here. I think that looking at the ephemeral messaging platforms or collaboration or communication platforms that an organization is using internally to conduct business, I do think there's sort of a step to check which platforms are being used and are they using it in the relevant business areas for that particular matter. So I think there's that aspect. And then I think when we talk about social media, I think that's another avenue. Considering that there are numerous social media networks, I think that there's also some due diligence to connect with custodians as well as understanding which social media sites or networks they may belong to in order to scope, right? We have Facebook, we have LinkedIn, we have YouTube, we have WhatsApp, the list goes on and on. So I think there's some activities to really understand which sources may actually be relevant. Where does the custodian have accounts or where are they active?
And how far can you ethically go? So I'm just wondering what the ethical duties are here. Could someone go on Facebook and friend somebody they suspect to be a witness? Could someone use the WhatsApp profile of a spouse or friend in order to sort of dig for information from somebody without that person knowing who's trying to collect the information? What are the ground rules there?
Well, the first ground rule is that which someone has communicated to the entire world hardly is private. So therefore, I know of no ethical conscription against doing the digging. The exact opposite is true. There are a few states' ethics opinions that stand for the proposition that this stuff is so easily available and can be so significant that it may be unethical not to examine it and not to find out what is there. It may be part of your duty of competence under Rule 1.0, the Model Rules of Professional Responsibility, or the state equivalent. Now, in terms of the more sophisticated question you ask, that is, I am a lawyer, and I know this person is a witness. It is clear, at least according to some state opinions, that you cannot disguise your identity. That is, you cannot use your paraprofessional as a stalking horse and let her friend that person. Those ethic opinions consider that a kind of deception, which is inappropriate under the Model Rules of Professional Responsibility. But in the absence of that, as I say, if the information is public and generally accessible, I don't understand why you would have to identify yourself to get it. But if you are digging for information which is not public, you cannot disguise your identity to mislead someone.
I think just to add on that point, Judge, I do think that when you talk about potentially where you can collect from, so thinking about how we use mobile devices today and understanding that there's a lot of BYOD policies or other types of nuanced situations, I think we get into a situation where a company-issued laptop might be different than someone's personal device. And so I think what resides on the device itself versus what's on social media, that's just another layer, I think, that adds to make this a pretty challenging space to navigate.
What sensitivity should folks be concerned about when you're dealing with activities on an employer's computer or other device?
Well, the first aspect of it is how you use that computer. There's a very New Jersey case. What happened was a young woman worked there. She had been in communication with a lawyer. It looks like the axe was going to fall. And over a period of time, she communicated with a lawyer. Well, the axe did fall, and she was fired. And then her bosses went through her email. Now, she had used the boss's email to connect with her Google account. But since that link was there, the New Jersey court condemned what the lawyers did. So there is guidance there, I suppose. There are other states that may not agree with that, that when the employee is warned that this is not your computer and everything that goes on here belongs to us, perhaps that claim that the New Jersey court found attractive would not be attractive to another place. And certainly there's a case in New York dealing with that situation. And I can tell you, when I was a judge, I opened that computer every morning and got a warning that the computer did not belong to me, that my privacy was not protected when it was used, and so forth and so on. So if in the teeth of that, you continue to use the boss's computer for your own personal work and, to my chagrin, put privileged stuff on it, you may be doing something that is going to be very troublesome and lead to the disclosure of information you may not want to be disclosed.
And you were discussing the duty to preserve and also the concept of a litigation hold, which is kind of what triggers more of a duty to preserve. When can people get in trouble for spoliation? So if there's no litigation yet, but you are concerned about some, or, you know, some items that you posted, and you run around and delete a bunch of things, or, you know, you sort of use an ephemeral data form with the hope that, you know, it's only going to last for 45 days and then disappear. Are there any concerns with that, or is that all fine as long as there isn't a specific litigation hold that pertains to that data?
No, the obligation flows from the anticipation of litigation. That yields the litigation hold. But before that happens, you still have to anticipate litigation and preserve. So let's suppose Susan Smith comes to Human Resources and she complains that every time there is travel, it always goes to the men. And she says something like, you know, I know my rights and I've had enough of this. And I know my rights. You might get quite a few lawyers who say you could anticipate litigation from that. From that moment on, you cannot purposely destroy anything that is relevant. That's spoliation. It can lead under Rule 37 of the Federal Civil Rules of Civil Procedure to some very serious consequences. Now, the nicer question, which Jennifer can address, is I go around in the corporation to see who has information. And one of the employees say, well, we use this piece of software for internal communications, and it's called the XYZ piece of software. It doesn't preserve anything. And the lawyer says, well, have you used that to talk about this woman's case? Oh, yes, we did. Oh, dear. I don't think if they were at a point where they anticipated litigation where they did that and purposely tried not to preserve it, the court may conclude that is spoliation, that violates Rule 37 because it was motivated by an intent to deny the other person the benefit of that. So you're not out of the woods yet. And then you get into some nice questions of what are you going to do then? What's gone is gone. There's not much you could do about that. But maybe now the moment has come where you have to interdict it and say, no, any discussions about her, you can't use that piece of software because we're going to have to preserve them.
I think that, you know, what's gone is gone. That is what it is, right? But at the same time, I think the communication around which technology or platforms are used should come from someone in the legal department to correct that behavior so that you can preserve as required for this matter. But I think taking a step back again, I think having an understanding of what technology and platforms you have in place and are being used by your employees is critical to help you navigate preservation requirements proactively, right? So if you understand that there's, you know, maybe two or three different, you know, major enterprise communication platforms, understanding holistically who within the organization may be using these will help you sort of navigate those challenges. Also, acceptable use policies and guidance for your users around when you should be using which platforms, you know, will help sort of navigate those complexities. But I think having a general overview of what you have and how it's being used, as well as the technical capabilities. So, RJ, I think at the beginning we talked a little bit about different types of ephemeral messaging, right? And so I think there's certain platforms that exist today that are designed to be and claim to be completely ephemeral in that there is deliberate, permanent deletion of data. It's essentially never captured, and there's no archiving and storage capabilities. Then you have other platforms that are maybe able to be configured or otherwise indicate the retention period or the timeline in order to have a window or a buffer. So let's say we keep these messages for 30 days and then they're expired or completely deleted. So I think there's different types of platforms and different capabilities, and they're very nuanced. And so understanding all of those technical aspects of your platform will help you as you navigate, you know, the challenges of preservation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So maybe now we should move on to some discussion of capture, collection, and review. So we could start with just generally, what do you recommend in terms of capturing and collecting social media and other ephemeral data?
Well, the courts have been very suspect of the collection being done by someone who may be accused of wrongdoing. There's a famous case that I never could believe in which the boss put in charge of the collection the two people who were accused of assaulting this woman. You know, sometimes stupidity just overwhelms you, but the courts have emphasized that collection is a process that is designed to capture this information, and beginning at least with the Zubelate case, and whether lawyers like it or not, they have said that is a responsibility of counsel. And when counsel merely delegates this to the client, he should or she should not be surprised when there are problems down the line. So the lawyers have a new kind of duty to create this collection process so that it is, will capture what is needed. And obviously, the lawyers are going to come into problems. The lawyer visits the employee who discloses he's been using his computer to run a nice little gambling den. And then the lawyer has to say, well, my friend, I don't represent you. And that's a violation of our policies. So it's a very nettlesome problem. And a lawyer has to be very careful, primarily because this is the lawyer's responsibility. He or she just can't delegate it and hope it goes away.
Judge, you said the lawyer needs to sort of collect what is needed. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what is needed. In other words, is it sufficient to get static images?
I think Jennifer will tell you better than this, but the collections I have seen usually are a collection in native. The great king of native is my dear friend Craig Ball, and Craig writes a blog every week about the importance of collection in native because of its capability to preserve the metadata. So the better collection is native. Basically, you are using the definition of relevance in Rule 401 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. It's evidence which makes a material proposition more likely than it would be without the evidence. That's a broad standard. So your initial collection is probably going to be wide and then be narrowed. So the first collection should be as broad as it can be, given human reason, in terms of estimating whether this is significance. Now, as we transfer from a collection that is individual to a collection that's network-wide, then Jennifer could explain to us what tools are available to the collection without having to talk to human beings. And as we get more and more dependent upon technology-assisted review, ultimately leading to artificial intelligence, that maybe becomes a different problem.
Jennifer, you want to comment?
Yeah, a couple of things there that I think would be nice to chat about. The first being, as we talk about e-discovery, right, and how that is really where we're at, there's not really paper really that much anymore. Everything is being collected, reviewed electronically, produced electronically. We do need to, I think, consider, you know, as we develop teams to support preservation and collection and the broader electronic discovery processes, is the role of a technologist or those who really are tech savvy. Because I think even the well-intentioned person could make a mistake. And in the case of, you know, not capturing metadata or making a mistake around choosing the wrong technology to support a collection, those are all big stakes, right? And so having sort of a partnership with a provider, in-house capability, whatever direction your organization goes, making sure that you have folks who really understand the technology and the nuances to help navigate these legal processes, I think are critical. And kind of along those lines, right, when we're talking about these different social media platforms or ephemeral messaging applications, you know, one, understanding the technology enough to know what exists and what's available to collect or not, understanding the nuances of your particular system and how it's been configured. So previously I talked a little bit about purely ephemeral versus, you know, maybe there's been a retention set. So knowing even what there is there to capture. And then lastly, what technology exists on the market, either to proactively address this or from a reactive collection standpoint. So there are different technologies that are emerging in the market right now to support social media preservation and collection, where they can kind of go out and scan multiple sites, run searches, and bring it in. And I think this technology was referenced in some recent case law around collection of Facebook Messenger messages and some challenges related to the preservation of metadata. The other item I would point out here is that we do see some additional technology on the market that are being called archivers. So they essentially help support the ephemeral messaging applications and different data sources, chats, texts, etc., in order to put something under hold. So it helps the organization sort of look at what they have and be able to have some sort of formal technology and mechanism in place to try to capture that information. So I do believe that the sort of legal technology and compliance market is looking to sort of catch up with these data sources and build solutions that will help organizations and legal teams navigate all of these various risks and compliance needs.
So Jennifer, I actually have two questions about what you said. The first question is, both you and Judge Facciola mentioned metadata. So I was hoping you could say a little bit more about what that is and what types of metadata people should be looking to collect. And then also, you mentioned that there's a lot of technology tools in the market and being developed, and also, you know, the usefulness potentially of engaging an outside vendor. And without discussing necessarily any specific tools or vendors, you know, if I'm a medium-sized business, what should I be looking for in terms of selecting technology tools and vendors?
Yeah, there's a few questions there. I'll start with the first. And I will think back to when I first graduated from college and I started working at a small e-discovery vendor. I asked what metadata was, and they said it's data about the data. So I think that's in its simplest form, but a little more technical, I would say that it's different pieces of information that may include timestamps, authors, file types, all sorts of information that is attached to that particular piece of data or file that can help provide more context around the file itself, who created it, when was it created, et cetera. So I think that hopefully will resonate with folks. And then thinking a little bit about to your next questions around, you know, use of providers and different technologies. You know, I think one of the things that's really important to consider is, just like you would with any type of provider within legal services, is credentials, qualifications, sort of the same due diligence that you would expect to apply to any type of expert or other type of service provider. So I can tell you that, you know, as a service provider myself, when we engage with corporations, there's oftentimes many questions about our experience serving similar industries, different types of matters, what are our qualifications, credentials, and experiences. So I think those are all really important things to consider when you're trying to select a service provider or a vendor to help out with these types of legal technology issues. Did I get all your questions?
Yes, that was wonderful. You hit everything. Before we move on, I just wanted to ask, are there anything that could be considered best practices for collection and review? I know we've touched on some items.
Yeah, well, we now live in a world, in litigation at least, which is going to be the product of an agreement between the parties. And they will usually have a very sophisticated protocol in terms of how the collection will be done. And they will denominate the metadata that is going to be produced. So of the 128 fields that are possible there, they will pick the ones they want in the way Jennifer told you, date, from, to, so forth. So that is going to yield either of two types of production. We don't want to get into the weeds, but one would be native. The other is called load files or metadata. But the point is that you are attempting as a lawyer to try to create a system that will capture all the data that will tell you not only what it says, but when it was created it, who commented upon it, what time was it, and so forth and so on. So that's why the metadata is so important in this process. Now, under the rules, you can specify the way you want the format to be. If you don't specify it, you will get the default, which is as it was created or a reasonably usable format. But we sort of reached the point where some formats are already being said not to be reasonably usable. I always tell my students never to accept PDFs because they're just a picture. Okay, where are the comments the other people made about that draft? Who wrote it? Who sent it to whom? All of that is accessible. There certainly is no privilege against its production. So in the world in which we live, you should be working towards a production that is close to native as you can get away with, because that's the one that's going to be more useful. And then, as Jennifer will explain to you, it'll hook in to the systems that the vendor is going to use to help you capture that information so you can search and use it. In other words, this whole process is now mechanical from its inception to its conclusion.
I think I would go back to echo just a couple of points we touched upon earlier when we talk about best practices. I think prior to, you know, anticipating a legal matter, prior to getting down collection review, et cetera, I think many organizations are taking a step back and really looking at what is my data footprint, what do I have, what technologies am I using, so that they are better armed and ready for when a legal matter hits and when they receive the notice, or when they're anticipating a legal matter or regulatory investigation or what have you. And I think some of these best practices there ties into some other related drivers around privacy and other types of legislation that are really asking organizations to understand what they have, why they have it, where it is. So I think from a best practices that perspective, sort of mapping that data and knowing what you have not only helps you when it comes to preservation, collection, review, et cetera, but also helps you meet some of these other factors that organizations need to worry about, as you know, privacy compliance and cyber risk and things like that.
And an important point here, I think, that bears some emphasis. Jennifer and I certainly are not saying you should keep everything. The converse is true. When you keep everything, you increase the cost of finding anything by some multiple. And given our society, the last thing you want to do is to give cyber criminals more to steal from you. No one is suggesting that. What we are suggesting is there's got to be a records management policy and somebody in charge of it. These are the sales invoices from 3 years ago. Do we have to keep them? No, we don't. That is an eminently reasonable decision, and is the kind of decision you should be making on a daily basis. Americans will never be accused of not accumulating enough data. I'm a hypocrite because I was looking for something today with a little search on my hard drive, and to my horror, I found files from 2013. Now,
it's hard to give it up.
But one of these days, I'm going to clean off my hard drive. It's right after I finish reading Proust. Then I'm going to clean my hard drive.
Yeah, Judge, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that organizations have multiple different priorities that they're juggling. Obviously, they may have record-keeping requirements driven by their regulator, right? So we know there's different books and records requirements coming out of the SEC. We have all sorts of different requirements in healthcare, et cetera. You need to balance that with not over-retaining things that you don't need. And then as you enter in the GDPR and others, they're really looking at retention limitations as well as data minimization principles. So it's sort of a melting pot of all these conflicting things, and you and your organization needs to balance out what you need to keep for regulatory or business reasons and what you should consider getting rid of. And so I think that's where you see this, at least in a business context, the rise of ephemeral messaging platforms really coming in, because yeah, it does help an organization sort of balance some of those info governance and privacy requirements.
And there's a lot of good stuff out there about records management. Sedona had an entire working group, part of the eDiscovery working group, working on this issue, and have a lot of good stuff on records management. There's a lot of good stuff out there that we as a society should be taking more seriously. Because I say, every time we keep something we don't need, we increase how attractive our stuff is to a cyber criminal. Mm-hmm. And that's the last thing we want to do.
Are those the types of sources we should be consulting, if we're a company and setting up a data retention policy?
Surely. And there are certain, I don't know if Jennifer's organization provides such services, but there are actually people who come in and do audits. They will look at the vulnerability of your system, tell you where your vulnerability is.
Judge, I've done a few of those myself.
Yeah. And part of that, I'm sure Jennifer is telling them, why in the world are you keeping all of this stuff? You're just making things infinitely more complicated for no good reason.
There is this tendency, usually driven by some old legal hold or old legal matter, where it's, I got to keep it all just in case legal needs it. But the reality is, I think the risk appetite for that has changed. And it's, no, please don't keep that unless we need to, and in which case we absolutely should. But do you need 17 versions of this PowerPoint from 5 years ago? Maybe not. I think that there's plenty of organizations who can help supporting, the detailed record schedule, which will tie to all the various legal citations depending on your region and jurisdiction. And then other companies such as myself and EY who can come in and sort of help organize or help come up with a strategy and procedures to help not only keep what you need to, but begin disposition of what you no longer need to, while consulting with legal and other groups that have other requirements around different legal matters.
And where do you think eDiscovery and ephemeral data is heading in the next year? What should folks be looking out for?
I anticipate its use will increase, certainly given how attractive it is in so many ways. I read a good article just yesterday in Wired magazine, and when DuckDuckGo came out, nobody would spend a buck to invest in it. What's the big deal? You don't keep the information. Look at their profit figures. So anybody who underestimates how much Americans want privacy is going to lose a lot of money. So I see this growing, and that's not a bad thing. The exploitation of our information has reached tragic consequences in many ways. And maybe this is the time. And people are, as Lenin used to say, they voted with their feet. They are not going to these platforms because of any is forced into them, but just they're just tired of making an inquiry as to hotel rates and proceeding to get 25 ads in 30 seconds later. I know the browser I use blocks all that stuff, and I think it's a wonderful invention. So to answer your question, this is going to grow and become more challenging for lawyers. And as Jennifer said, they're going to have to weave into their clients' business affairs records management that allows for this new generation that wants to use this software.
I think that's right. And I'd add that I think additional technology and advances in the current platforms will be underway, particularly for business use, right? So you could have a personal account with a certain application for communications with your friends and family, non-business related. But I think that there will be an increase into those platforms to help support some of the business processes, particularly around retention of records, legal preservation, other types of compliance requirements. So I think that'll come as well. And then the other thing that I'm seeing already and I think will continue is just sort of a coming together of a lot of the different cross-functional teams within businesses, including legal, technology, compliance, to really understand the technologies they have, how they bring it in, how they govern it, so that they have that holistic view and to manage those risks together, as opposed to, I think, what has previously been a little bit of silos. And so I think that trend is coming, and I think we'll see more of that.
Okay, great. So now, if you're willing, I'm going to take us to a set of four closing questions that we're going to ask everyone who is a guest speaker on our podcast. So I'd ask that each of you comment, but you don't have to say a lot necessarily. It just depends on, you know, what comes to your mind. So question one is, what would be one actionable, monetizable takeaway for our listeners from today?
I made the joke during our prep that you should go start your own ephemeral messaging or social media network, but I think we're a little saturated right now. I think, you know, one of the things that someone could walk away today is, you know, if you are an in-house legal professional or if you are outside counsel, really do some research and familiarize yourself with the technology that's available that your colleagues and or your clients may be using. So I think that's one thing that's a fairly quick way to get abreast of what's out there and help you serve your clients or your colleagues.
Great. Judge Facciola?
To the lawyers out there, it's now long past due to increase your technical competence, which is now part of your ethical responsibilities under Rule 1. Subsection comment 8 to that indicates the lawyer must keep abreast of the benefits and dangers of the new technology. So it's no longer optional. So it is no longer an excuse to say, gee, Judge, we didn't keep that stuff because I didn't know what that WhatsApp thing was. You know, my grandchildren use that, but I don't know. So this is a time where you cannot delegate to someone else the fundamental requirement that you understand this stuff. I go tired of saying this, but the world keeps changing, and lawyers will be of service to the society only insofar as they keep up with that society's technological developments. And that's bankable. And the proof is in the pudding. Mm-hmm. Those are the lawyers who are attractive to the clients. Why would you go to a lawyer for advice when he doesn't know what you're talking about?
All right, question number two. If a student or someone more junior would like to do what you do or get into your area, what advice would you give to them?
So the first advice that I would give is explore related certifications. I think certifications are a great way to understand the subject matter and sort of give yourself an overview of what's in the area before maybe investing in a four-year degree. They also allow you to really stay on top of things. So different certifications are emerging in all sorts of different related information governance functions. There's lots of technology-specific certifications. There's broad privacy and information governance. So I think that's a great way to sort of get involved and get kind of up to speed in the area. The other thing I would say is the most successful people that I've seen in the legal technology and sort of compliance space are those who understand business processes, information systems and information environments, as well as emerging technology. and being able to navigate the conversation between a lawyer, an IT professional, and a business individual is really critical to success in this environment.
To young people who are considering a career in law, I would tell them the wisest advice would be to attend Georgetown Law School.
Excellent advice, Judge Fitzgerald.
We now have 70 courses. Can you believe that? 70 courses about the intersection of law and technology. Now, that obviously, it's not only my employer, but it's all my alma mater. So, but being objective as possible, I can say I don't know of a law school worthy of the name that's not doing this, whether it is in the classroom, curricular activities, or so forth. This is where the world is. So young people doing this might want to do a couple of things. As I tell my grandsons, if you don't know how to program, you probably want to take a course in Python or something like that, just so you get an idea of what computers are all about. From that point on, see if you can develop some expertise. But more importantly, when you get to law school, avail yourselves of these opportunities. One of our students is a remarkable young man. He's what we call our tech scholars who come to the law school experience or background in computer science. And while he was at the law school, he showed the United States Senate how to hack into a voting machine.
Whoa.
So as you can imagine, he's not having trouble finding potential employers. So you simply have to commit yourself that this is the world you want to live in. And this is where lawyers are. You may not like that. You know, you might want to see yourself as the next Clarence Darrow. Well, good for you. But clients have needs, and you're going to have to fill those needs.
And I think this shutdown showed us the importance of technological competence for legal practice. So question number three, can you recommend an article, book, blog, website, talk, or any other resource that you think our listeners should check out?
So Judge Fatiola, you mentioned the Sedona conference earlier, so I'm going to do a little shameless plug here. The Sedona conference recently published a commentary on ephemeral messaging that's been out for public comment for a few months now, and I think the team is getting ready to release that. So I was a member of that drafting committee, and it does talk about a lot of what we discussed today, certain guidelines around use, outlines of potential business risks, as well as benefits and sort of the tensions that exist within this space. So I think it's a great way to learn a little bit more about this area. I think there's some great webinars and other types of virtual events that are going on right now. And obviously those are great for a lot of reasons to be able to watch a pre-recorded session. But, you know, EY is putting out a legal compliance and technology series, as well as several law firms and other types of practitioners that really talk about what we're talking about today, law, technology, and how it's all coming together.
You know, it's almost a chore to be ignorant in the society in which we live. If you do a little bit of digging, I always tell my students, think of what it took for Jefferson to get a book about botany from France, right? The book had to cross an ocean. You can click a keystroke and learn all there is to know about one of these topics. I agree that Sedona is unique in what it does, and that is a worthwhile place to start. There are several excellent blogs out there which are run by lawyers. There are magazines such as Law and Technology. There are ways to use LexisNexis, Westlaw, and Bloomberg to tag stuff, new cases that are coming out that will bring to your attention. That's also true of Case Text, which I think is free for most people. So I think you have to do some digging. But once you do even a minor amount of digging, you'll be almost overwhelmed how much there is. And then you become selective of it. And by the way, I don't consider this, you know, hard duty or torture. I really enjoy reading in this area, whether it is, I guess, show what a nerd I am. My favorite magazine is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Tech Review, and I look forward to it coming. And even I can understand some of it. And that's, but when I just think, you know, I mean, think about it. I mean, it drives me crazy how we take this for granted. We have an object on Mars which is communicating with us. And last week, it launched a helicopter on Mars. So if you want to make an argument in favor of being technologically a moron, boy, you're in the wrong society.
All right, and that brings us to the last question, which is, how can our listeners find out more about you and what you do?
The easiest way to get in touch with me or learn a little bit about myself would be on LinkedIn, Jennifer Joyce.
Because when we were judges, there were significant concerns about security, and there still are. We were told not to go on social media, so I never have. But I think the best thing I can tell you is that I'm a professor at Georgetown Law, and you can certainly reach me there. You could do something very strange. You could take one of these objects, which is called a pen, and another object, which is called a piece of paper. And you could put that in a third object called an envelope. And you'd be amazed what happens after you do that.
And Judge Facciola often teaches at our Advanced eDiscovery Institute and our eDiscovery Training Academy as well. And so that's probably another way you can hear more from him. So I think we have to leave it there. That's going to be it for this episode of Compliance and Legal Risk. I want to thank our guest speakers, the Georgetown Law and EY teams, and of course, all of you for tuning in. If you like what you heard, please check out the resources on our website, subscribe or tell a friend, and leave us a review wherever you're listening. Please keep in mind that the opinions of speakers are their own and do not represent the views of Georgetown University or EY. Nothing presented in Compliance and Legal Risk or on its website should be construed as legal advice or as creating an attorney-client relationship. Until next time, stay compliant and control your legal risks.